We're looking this morning at the Gospel of Mark. And as we think about the Gospel of Mark, as we've been studying about the life of Jesus Christ, the Gospel of Mark is one of my favorites because it's short and to the point. It's perfect for our rush, rush, hurry, hurry American society that's always going here and going there and doesn't have time for something that's long and drawn out. Mark's gospel is just over half as long as the longest of the gospels. It's much, much shorter, and he is brief about his explanations of things. So we're going to cover all 16 chapters this morning. Honestly, if I were a fast reader, I really could probably read the Gospel of Mark in right around 30 to 40 minutes. You can read the whole thing, but I'm not that fast of a reader, so we're not going to. How many of you have heard of mosaics? Picture mosaics in particular. We have a picture of a dog up here on the screen, and it's not just any dog. Well, it is just any dog. I have no idea what dog it is. It's not my dog. It's just a dog. But what's interesting about this dog, and you've probably seen these before, is that this dog is made up of a bunch of other pictures of other things. And so here we have a little pullout of just its eye, and as you can see, there are several other pictures that make up that area that's its eye. That's the way I want us to view this today. Today, as we look at the Gospel of Mark, we're going to do the overview. We're going to look at this. But later on, as we go through studying about Jesus, then we're going to focus in on some of the other pictures that Mark paints of Jesus' life. So today, we're just getting the bird's eye view. We're getting the large picture of the way that things are. The Gospel of Mark is not just a collection of stories that Mark had heard. I know there are some in the religious world that will just say, well, Mark heard these stories and so he just collected them and wrote them down. No, no. Mark's gospel is written purposefully. He puts together the stories that emphasize the picture of Jesus that he wants to paint. You ever wonder why there are four different gospels? I mean, why not just one that has everything? Why four different ones? Well, the reason is there are different kinds of people. And different kinds of people are drawn to different ways of looking at an individual. Well, Mark, of course, again, tells the quick, short version. He's kind of the Cliff's Notes or the Reader's Digest version of the Gospels. He has chosen specifically certain stories that point out certain things about Jesus. One of the things that we notice in Mark's Gospel is Mark doesn't dwell on the birth or early life of Jesus. He just picks things up when Jesus is already an adult and about to begin his ministry. He just starts right there and kicks right in. His account leaves out a lot of the things that are in the other accounts. Not because they weren't important, but because they didn't emphasize what he wanted us to see about Jesus. You know, the thing about Jesus is he has so many facets. There are so many details about his life. John tells us that if all the things about Jesus' life were written down, the whole world couldn't contain the books. So all of them had to pick and choose what they recorded. And Mark chose these to emphasize some things about Jesus. He wants to emphasize something special about this. Not a philosopher, although Jesus was, but that's John's gospel. Not just the Jewish king, that's Matthew's gospel. Not just the wise one who has all the wisdom of the ages, that's Luke's gospel. But the conquering king who goes out and does and is active. And we see this right off the bat in the first chapter. And Mark's gospel is the only one that includes some of the accounts of things like Christ's own family thinking he'd gone crazy. in Mark chapter 3, verses 19 through 21. The parable of the seed growing secretly in chapter 4, verses 26 through 29. The healing of a blind man at Bethesda in chapter 8 and verses 22 through 26. So why does Mark include some of these things that others left out that were and then tell some thing, leave out some things that the others told? Well, Mark is trying to show Jesus the Messiah as an active worker in people's lives, and he wants to see the powerful meaning of discipleship as well. And so he points those things out time and time again. So as we think about that, as we consider the prologue, notice he starts off in the scripture that was read to us just a moment ago. None of the other Gospels start like this. The beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. He doesn't hold back any punches. He doesn't want any surprises later on. He doesn't want to reveal things. He just flat out tells you right at the beginning, I'm going to tell you the story about the Son of God, Jesus Christ. Just going to tell you about Him. Right off the bat, He says that. But then He says, in verse 2, as the prophet Isaiah said, I'm sending my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way. Well, why would His way need to be prepared? Because what Mark is telling us is, yes, He's the Christ, He's the Son of God, but you might not recognize Him. We talked about that in our class this morning a little bit, that when Jesus did come, He was not the Messiah that many of the Jews were expecting. He wasn't the one who was going to come and make Israel a mighty kingdom that was going to rule over other nations with an iron fist and a sword and all those kind of things. And that's what they were expecting. So Mark starts out by saying, yes, He's the Son of God, but He's not the kind of Messiah you're expecting. He's different. And let me tell you then how He's different. You're not going to recognize Him if you don't know what to look for. So then he talks about Jesus being the reluctant Messiah. And he condemns the blindness of the people who just won't see and just won't hear and just won't understand who He really is. So for the first half of the book, 8 chapters, Jesus is this reluctant Messiah. Now when we say reluctant, we say, wait a minute, what do you mean? Jesus didn't want to be the Messiah? Yes, He did. But when we say He was reluctant to reveal Himself in the first part of His ministry. He revealed Himself to individuals, but He didn't want to reveal Himself to the world. And these discussions happen on various occasions with Him. That, well, why don't you, you know, if you really are, why don't you tell everybody? Why don't you reveal yourself to the world? And He would say, it's not time yet. There was going to come a time He was going to reveal everything to them. But at first, He was reluctant to let everyone know the secret of who He was. The action in these first few chapters, and action is a key word in the Gospel of Mark. We'll notice that all you have to do is read the first chapter and realize that the first few verses are John the Baptizer talking and doing things. And it's not until verse 9 that Jesus comes along. And I want you to go through there. You don't have to do it right now, but take this home for the week and read the rest of Mark chapter 1 and just count how many things Jesus does in Mark chapter 1. He's busy. He's not loafing around. He's not sitting around. He's not laying around being lazy. He's busy. So when we say reluctant Messiah, we don't mean that He's not doing things or that He's not active or working or that He doesn't want to do it. He does want to do it, but it's not time for Him to be revealed fully to the world yet. So as we consider that, He allows the deeds. Mark shows Christ's deeds. Always it's what He did and what He did. Not to say that He doesn't do anything with the teachings of Christ But he doesn't have the long, drawn-out discourses like the Sermon on the Mount, which is, you know, like 15 minutes long, so like super long sermon right there. You know, he doesn't have the prayers like John 17 has. He doesn't do those things. He has these quick, brief encounters, and then he moves on to the next one. And that really fits with our society today. He starts in chapter 1 with this theme that's kind of the theme for the whole book. The kingdom is near. The kingdom is coming. And Jesus is preaching that just like John had been preaching it. John, of course, has been imprisoned in verse 14. And so Jesus begins to take on that role of proclaiming the gospel. He's telling the good news to all who will listen. And then we see the beginning of verse 16 on that people begin to evaluate Jesus. And Mark shows us this evaluation. What are people thinking? What are people wanting to do with this new guy who's come on the scene preaching and teaching about the kingdom coming and about this good news, this gospel? What are we going to see? What are we going to hear? What do we want from him? Well, his growing popularity shows up in verses 16 through 45 of chapter 1 as we see him doing things actively and everybody's starting to find him. The four fishermen decide to follow him. People are amazed and the news spreads as they see miracles. And then toward the end of that section, the miracles actually start to get in the way of the message because people are so interested in the miracles that they're not wanting to listen to teaching. And his opposition begins to grow as well in chapter 2 and the first part of chapter 3. There are five of these little controversial stories where Jesus and the religious leaders butt heads a little bit because of the things that he's doing and saying. He claims to forgive sins, and they think that's blasphemous, which it would be if he wasn't God. Jesus eats with tax collectors and sinners, and they think that's horrible in verses 13 through 17 of chapter 2. Then Jesus talks about fasting and dealing with the fasting and why aren't your disciples fasting, all that in chapter 2 and verses 18 through 22. And then there are two conflicts over the Sabbath at the end of chapter 2 and the first few verses of chapter 3. And then in chapter 3 and verse 6, it all comes to a head. There's the decision made to kill Jesus. So the Pharisees went out immediately and began plotting with the Herodians. Now that's an amazing thing because the Pharisees and the Herodians did not like each other. Herod and his family were descended from Esau, and he is king over Israel, the descendants of Jacob. They don't like Herod. And the Pharisees really don't like him. But they've found a new enemy that's more of a threat to them than the known enemy. You know the old saying, you know, the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know. Well, they considered Jesus to be the devil they didn't know. And that's really how they referred. I mean, they even talked about him like he was the devil. They hated him, and so they teamed up with the Herodians, and it says they plotted as to how they could assassinate him or destroy him, kill him. They wanted him gone. And so that happens at the beginning of Mark chapter 3. They're already plotting this. Now that's, again, very different than the other Gospels. The other Gospels, you're well into the Gospels before you realize that there are these enemies that are actually plotting to kill him. But here we are, right at the beginning of chapter 3. Mark's already telling us what's going on with these enemies. And then there's more of a reaction of confusion about Jesus as we go into the rest of chapter 3. The crowds like him. He's working miracles. He's healing people and things like that. That's good. They like that. There are a few people who have even committed themselves to be his disciples and follow him. His own family, as we mentioned earlier, thinks he's gone crazy. I mean, they've known him. knew you when you was a kid. What's wrong with you? What are you doing? Who do you think you are? And they actually come on at one point and come and they want to drag him back home because they think he's just totally lost it. The religious leaders think he's possessed by a demon or that he is the devil himself, in essence. So you have all these different reactions. And there's not a consensus as to who Jesus really is or what he is really all about. But then we want to talk about understanding the kingdom a little bit. In chapter 4, Jesus turns his focus. He tells four parables about the kingdom that summarize the different ways that people are going to respond to his teachings and the good news that he's preaching. And so he begins to share that. So we have a little bit of his teaching there. Then we have at the end of chapter 4 on to chapter 8. Again, who is this Jesus? Who is he? He's been introduced to him and they're kind of evaluating who he is now. Who is he really? Who's he going to be? His name becomes well known. He calms the storm. And his disciples even are asking, who is this guy who can control the weather? And that's, fixing somebody that's sick is one thing, but controlling the weather? They're really stumped by that. They're wondering, who is this guy that we've hooked up with? Who is this fellow we're following? He heals the demon-possessed man. And the people don't know who Jesus is, and they don't really want to find out. They beg, just go away. We don't want you, your kind around here. They're disturbed by him. And then he raises Jairus' daughter. And after he raises Jairus' daughter, it's just interesting because he only allowed his inner circle and Jairus and the mother to go in with him when he healed her. And then in verse 43 of Mark chapter 5, it says, he strictly charged them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat. Why would you do a miracle? Why would you raise somebody from the dead and then say, don't tell anybody about this? Well, he wasn't ready to reveal himself quite yet. Not fully. He wasn't ready for that time to come. Because he knew what the end result of that would be. Then in chapter 6, we have even his own home folks confused about who he is. And we see even King Herod in Mark chapter 6, verses 14 through 16. Nobody knows who he is. King Herod heard of these miracles that he'd been doing. And he says, what? And this is after he had killed John the Baptist. He said, this is John the Baptist. He's been raised from the dead. That's why all these miraculous powers are working in him. And that's his response to it. Verse 15 says, but others said he's Elijah. Others said he's one of the prophets, like the prophets of old. But Herod, no. He's John come back to life. Herod's demons are haunting him. He had killed an innocent man. But the people don't understand. And in chapter 6 through 8, are you still not understanding who I am? You still not know what I'm here to do? The hard-heartedness of even his own disciples is stressed in the section of the end of chapter 6 through chapter 8. The disciples don't recognize his power in chapter 6, verses 30 to 45. He walks on the water and they don't understand. Verses 46 through 56. In chapter 7, they're confused by his teaching. They don't understand what he's teaching. And then the section ends with another feeding story where he feeds them more food. And his last words, the end of chapter 8, are, "Do you still not understand?" After all this time and all that you've seen, you still don't understand. But then we see him becoming the radical Messiah. And he confronts their blindness in chapter 8 and all the way through chapter 10. And then in this case, the action takes place on the way. This middle section of Mark is the identity of Jesus comes more to the surface. People see for sure, and they've got to start taking sides. They've got to make a decision. He's confronting this head on. Now it's time that he's revealed a little more. And you're going to have to decide, are you going to follow me or not? You're going to have to be willing to die if you follow me. It's not going to be easy if you follow me. Three times in these three chapters, Jesus tells his followers that he is going to have to go die. And each of those three times, they don't understand. They're blind to what he's telling them. They reject it. Of course, we know, Peter rejects it all the way up to the end when he just flat out tells them, and this is not from Mark, but from Matthew's Gospel, when Peter just comes up to him and Jesus just flat out tells him, I've got to go die. And Peter says, "Oh no, Lord, that can't happen to you." They still didn't understand. And Mark shows that as well in these chapters. We kind of have one of the hinge passages of the entire book is the healing of the blind man in chapter 8 and verses 22 through 26. This is a really unusual story. It's one that's not told in any of the other Gospels. And it's one that troubles people, especially if they don't understand why Jesus does it. This is the healing of a blind man, which we say, well, that's Jesus healed a lot of blind men. What's so significant about this one? He healed him partially the first time. And the man comes back and says, well, I see men walking around like trees. And then Jesus heals him the rest of the way. And so people a lot of times are confused. They say, what's wrong? Why can't Jesus heal? Is there something wrong with Jesus' power? He can't heal this guy? No, of course not. We've seen him heal people at other times, in other Gospels. There's no problem. He can heal anyone. Well then, why does it take him two tries to get this guy healed? Was there something harder about this one? No, that's not it at all. If we'll read the context again, what is it that Mark is trying to present to us? You're not recognizing the Messiah. You're not seeing clearly. And this is a hinge passage where Jesus points out to his disciples, here, you're like this blind man. You couldn't see at all. And then he heals him partway. And he could see some. Now you're like this blind man. You see kind of, but it's, real blurry and kind of like if I take my glasses off. You're still out there. I can kind of see you. But then Jesus heals him all the way to let them know, this is how I want you to be. This is where I want you to be, where you can see clearly. His disciples were still struggling. Things were still fuzzy to them. Things were still blurry. And this is one of the key passages where Jesus uses a miracle in two stages to teach his disciples a lesson, to teach them this message. And then the first shadow of the cross. Chapter 8, verse 27 through 9, 1. Peter confesses who he is. Jesus makes the prediction. And then the disciples are struggling with the dilemma of dealing with what Jesus has told them. And then just after that, a second shadow of the cross. As Jesus is trying to get them to see what's coming. We have in the first few verses up to verse 13, "This is my son, listen to him." Then the disciples are unable to heal. They're impotent. They don't have the power that they need to be able to heal someone. And then he makes the second prediction. You know, it's amazing. You have this transcendent majesty of this mountain experience where the disciples heard the voice of God, or at least the three, Peter, James, and John, heard, "This is my son, listen to him." And then that's contrasted with when they get down off the mountain, they can't even cast out a demon because of their lack of faith. Yeah. Jesus condemns them for their lack of faith and then heals and casts the demon out. And then Jesus adds to that negative time by going on to explain his coming death one more time. And then a third reference to the cross, a third shadow of the cross. Verses 33 of chapter 9 up to verses 45 of chapter 10. He begins to emphasize what he needs them to become, the radical nature of discipleship. "Become a servant and you'll be great. You won't be greater than your master, but you can be like your master. Become a child." Then you've got the rich young man. He calls to follow him and he won't do it because of his riches. And then you've got that third prediction that he's going to the cross, going to his death. And they still don't understand. Three times now he's told them, "I'm going to die. I'm going to be lifted up. I'm going to the cross." And they just won't accept it, perhaps. It's clear that they don't understand because James and John are asking for special privileges. "Lord, when you come in your glory, let us be on your right and left hand." "Really? You want to be hung on crosses right beside me? Is that what you're really wanting? Can you drink the cup I'm going to drink?" The others are upset. And there's infighting over who's going to be the most special, who's going to be his big helper, who's going to be the teacher's pet. They're missing the point. Just like we often miss the point. And then in chapter 10, verses 46 through 52, he heals Bartimaeus. Another hinge passage. Another healing of a blind man. This time, not in the two stages to teach the lesson, just healing this man. Helping him to see clearly again. And then, he's fully revealed as the Messiah. The blindness is removed. And you have to make your decision, are you with me or against me? What will it be? And here the action takes place in Jerusalem and around Jerusalem. Again, the action in Galilee, the action on the way, and the action now in Jerusalem. And Jesus makes it clear that He is the Messiah. His disciples still don't understand fully what that means. But there's no denying it at this point. They'll understand it after the cross, after the resurrection. The religious leaders, of course, are convinced all the more that Jesus is truly dangerous. Dangerous most particularly to them and their power and their leadership, if you can call it that, of the Jewish people. The authority of Jesus is clearly shown in chapter 11 and 12. He does deeds of authority. He has the triumphal entry, and then he cleanses the temple. You know, you would think somebody who didn't have the authority came in here and started throwing things around and driving people out, somebody would call the police to come arrest him. Wonder why they didn't. Here he comes into the temple, he's got a whip, he's throwing over tables, driving people out, driving animals all over the place. I mean, we'd at least get him on destruction of property, right? Something. They don't make the move against him right then in the public. Wonder why? Probably because they recognized he truly does have the authority to do what he's doing. They just didn't like it. They challenge him to prove his right to do all of these things. And he, as usual, gives them a cryptic response because he knows they won't accept it anyway. He teaches with words of authority. He teaches the power of faith, and the widow becomes a living example of giving up everything to follow God. Give it all up. Even your last penny, if it means getting to be a disciple of Jesus Christ. And then we see the failings of his disciples. He warns them, be on your guard, watch out. But they don't. They fall asleep. He warns, you're going to deny me. Peter doesn't listen. He's warned Judas. They don't listen. These disciples had to have been a struggle and a disappointment as he's coming to the cross, knowing that they're still not getting it and that they're not ready. They complain about a waste of perfume that's poured on him for his burial, he says. Judas agrees to betray Jesus. At the Last Supper, Jesus predicts that one would betray him, another would deny him, and they're all going to desert him. In Gethsemane, the disciples sleep while he's struggling and praying alone. When the soldiers come, of course, it's Judas that places the kiss on his cheek to mark him as the one. And then there's the final rejection that he faces. The trial, and then the crucifixion and the burial. Fortunately, of course, that's not the end. In chapter 16, we have the epilogue of the resurrection and the ascension with the Great Commission being given. And his disciples told, go be the disciples you ought to be now. And they change. They become those men that they should have been. But it was a struggle for them to get there. Becoming a disciple of Jesus Christ is not easy for any of us. Becoming the disciple he wants us to be is even harder. Jesus doesn't shy away from difficulties like that. And he calls on us not to shy away either. If you're here this morning and you have not become a disciple of Jesus Christ, if you're not one of his followers, the end of Mark tells us, he that believes and is baptized shall be saved. You can do that today if you have not. You can become a disciple of Christ. You can be born again, sins washed away, ready to walk a new life with him if you believe he is the Messiah. If you are a Christian, you are a disciple, but you haven't been being the disciple that you know he wants you to be. You need to make that decision today to turn over a new leaf. He's used to that disappointment, but He doesn't like it. He's really wanting us all to grow and become what He wants us to be. If you're not what you ought to be this morning, please come as we stand and sing the invitation song.